From Asia Society Switzerland, this is a special episode of State of Asia. I'm your host, Remco Tanis. Back when I was in high school, one of the graduation assignments was to write an essay on the emerging New World Order half a decade after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now it's April 9, 2024 as I'm recording this, and yesterday, without making me ponder the passage of time at all, Asia Society Switzerland hosted a live Oxford debate on, well, yet another New World Order, one that has yet to shake out, but one that is decidedly different in what powers it from the post-Cold War one I had to give deep thoughts on as a teenager in order to graduate high school. So yesterday, at the live event in a packed venue in Zurich, four stellar debaters teamed up in pairs to argue the motion, Asia's rise will lead to a new world order. An Oxford debate like this one is governed by strict time limits. Each team gets 5 minutes to present its opening arguments, either defending or countering the motion. That's followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal. At the end, each debater makes a final push for their argument in a succinct 2-minute statement. The reason we love this format is that it gives the audience a chance to hear the strongest arguments around a highly relevant and highly complicated issue. We organize these Oxford debates because we believe they're a great format that helps us to understand these issues from multiple angles, allowing us and our audience to form better informed opinions ourselves. So on this episode of the podcast, we bring you straight from the live debate, the opening statements, the rebuttals, and the closing arguments on the motion, Asia's rise will lead to a new world order. Kicking off the debate with a 5-minute opening statement supporting that motion is Abigail Vasselier, director at MERIX, the Mercator Institute for China Studies, based in Berlin, Germany.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I think no one would have doubts that the new world will be driven by Asia and centered around China. Think about the clothes you're wearing. They're coming from India, from Bangladesh, maybe from Pakistan. But let's face it, this is the old world. Think about the car you're going to be driving in like 5 years. Is it going to be a rolling iPad that is made in China? Because I think so. China has technology we don't have. China has potential we no longer have. And this is the world of tomorrow. Since the 1980s, the world has been talking about the Asian century as a potential, but this is no longer a potential. I think we can acknowledge that the Asian continent has emerged from 30 years of political changes, from an incredible economic growth. And let's be honest, for every one of you having a company today, is there a second market like China or like India with Indian potential? No, there is certainly not. And actually, in 2021, Brookings Institute predicted that the top four consumer markets in 2030 would be China, India, Indonesia, and the US. So you have a case for Asia being the next consumer market that we are not going to be able to replace. So in reality, I will argue that Asia's rise is on a speed and on a trajectory that no one of you had anticipated, and even us as Asia experts, and China is going to be the engine of it. The demographics are very clear. With an incredible integration in global supply chains, the large demographic wave that we are seeing coming from the Asian continent is simply going to translate into a big consumer market, which we are all going to benefit. And today, there is a reason why Europe exchange on a daily basis 2.3 billion euros per day with China. So we can have doubts, and we can de-risk, and we can put economic security as a motto of our economic trajectory, but at the end of the day, the Asia's rise will lead to the new world order, and there is no doubt about that. Asia could account for over half of global output by the middle of the century, and I think I've made my case for the global integration. Then, which country can today claim that it has lifted 800 million out of poverty in less than one generation? This is China. So we may disagree with the Chinese model, but today, when African countries or Latin American countries are looking at China's development, this is what they're seeing. And this is a big appealing model for these countries. Asia will become, if not already, already a technological hub. In 2023, the International Federation of Robotics declared that 33 of all newly deployed industrial robots were actually installed in Asia. So Asia has the capacity and has the demand for becoming a technological leader. And this comes with a price, and the price is the definition of a new geopolitical balance. And our future is intertwined. Every time China's economy is slowing down, our economy can feel it. Every time the financial market is shaking in Asia, we can feel it. This is our new reality. And if tomorrow there was to be a crisis in the Taiwan Strait, it would cost us $2 trillion in a blockade scenario. This gives you a sense that Asia is the place of crisis and also opportunity. So yes, China is going to be the engine that is going to reshape the new world. With that comes the question of US-China tensions. With that comes the question of what are our partners in the global south going to think, whether the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative is an attractive model for redefining the rules-based international order or not. But I think no one would have doubts that what we are looking at today is a new world order that is going to be reshaped by Asia. Finally, the question for us today is whether we want to acknowledge the trend of Asia's rise, recognize it and adapt to it, and make sure that we have a space in which we live in this new world or we live in denial.
Next, countering the motion that Asia's rise will lead to a new world order, here's Julia Gunther, Program Director, International Affairs at the German Körber Foundation.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I want to be provocative and actually claim in the next couple of minutes that today's motion that we are arguing is not based on one, but two false assumptions. First, that it's only Asia's rise that we need to look at to understand how the world order is going to develop. And second, that we will see a new world order emerge. Now, on the first false assumption, there is no way to neglect that Asia is on the rise, and we have just heard that. However, I want to give you three examples why we really should also consider other countries, I call them emerging middle powers, outside of Asia, to understand the changes that will go on in our world order. First, considering economic indicators. In 2024, 11 of the 20 fastest growing economies will be based on the African continent. Second, demographic factors. While China, South Korea, and also Japan, they're really challenged by an aging population and all the economic problems that this brings with, we see that on the African continent, 60% of the population is under the age of 25. This brings an enormous demographic dividend and a lot of opportunities and chances, as we can currently see when we look at the African startup sector that is driven by young Africans, and they have managed to raise funds of $3.3 billion in 2023. And I think that's a good example. The third example that I want to give you are global challenges. And the biggest challenge that we all face is climate change. We have to tackle that challenge. There's no way around it. And this will lead to new leadership. The Amazon rainforest is a place that is really crucial for tackling the climate change. And 60% of the Amazon rainforest are based on the Brazilian territory. We have already heard from the Brazilian leadership that they want to assume such a leadership role globally, and they will host the next climate conference, COP30, in 2025 in Belém. And they also put in their G20 presidency sustainability as a centerpiece of their agenda. So to sum it up, there's much happening outside of Asia, and with these countries rising, we will also see new leaders emerge. Now, about those countries and about the second false assumption that I want to tackle, that we will see a new order emerge. Asia, and I think Asia itself doesn't want a new order emerge, but even if it were so, it would need others to help it to make this massive change going on. And the countries I just talked about, these emerging middle powers, they really have no interest in such a big change. They are status quo powers. We have recently done a survey at Körber Stiftung that indicates that policymakers in emerging middle powers, 61% of them, they prefer a reform of the United Nations Security Council, not a replacement. And they also have 40% of them really high hopes that the G20 as an institution will tackle the challenges in the future. These are two institutions and groupings that are part of our existing order. So there's really no interest in replacing the key elements of our current order, the UN system, the international globalized trade, or also also common binding bodies for international law. There's also important documents that underline that there is really an interest in reform and improvement of the international order in these countries. An example is the Isolwini Consensus, a proposal of the African Union on how the United Nations could be reformed. Another example is the last G20 leaders declaration from India that indicates that the World Trade Organization is really crucial for our multilateral trade agreement, despite all the problems it has. So I think these examples show that these are all no cause for revolution. They are cause for reform, cause for improvement. And in these countries and in those regions, there's even positive examples that even if it takes time, improvement can happen in those reforms. One example is the fact that the African Union joined the G20 just last year. Another example is the African Union itself that emerged from a reform process within Africa of the Organization of African Countries.
The live debate continued with historian John Delury, a professor at Yonsei University in Seoul, South Korea, arguing in support of the motion.
That was an interesting move by Julia. The way I would interpret what you've heard so far is Abigail did such a perfect job proving the motion that Julia redefined the terms of the motion and made a very impressive speech in terms of Africa's rise and Latin America's rise, leading to a new world order and convincing, but our proposition is Asia's rise. And so the arguments already made by Abigail, establishing the rise of Asia and the transformation of the old world order, I think still stand, even if we agree with most or all of the points that Julia made. And the second key point in the other side's opening statement in terms of countries around the world, again, not particularly focused on Asia, but globally, that there's not really an alternative vision to the existing international institutions. We're not debating that. We don't really have to debate that. The question of whether there's revolution or reform, again, is sort of to the side of the key question, which is the status quo world order sort of unraveling before our eyes, and is a new world order emerging out of that, and is Asia central to that transformation? So with that rebuttal, let me also try to reinforce a little bit our attempt, and in a way mirror some of the moves that that the other side has made in terms of really getting us to think more about the proposition, because you know the proposition contains kind of these three premises that Asia is rising, which we've I think Abigail's convincingly established, that some kind of new world order will emerge. It's a future tense. It's not has emerged. It's that it will emerge, and that Asia's rise is in the middle of that, in some way leading it. I want to maybe even question the premise that Nico gave us in terms of what do we mean when we talk about these world orders? You know, what's the status quo world order, and what might the future, this new world order, look like? And in particular here, forgive me, since I'm trained as a historian, I have to try my best to bring some dates into the discussion and some historical background into the debate. And I would argue against some of the framing and against certainly a lot of the language that policy makers and diplomats would use, for example, in Washington, that the world order is not, you'll often hear the term again in the US discourse, the international rules-based order, which has apparently existed since 1945. As a historian, that's hard for me to accept. It's hard for me to buy. There was maybe a brief moment from 1944 to 1947, where there was such a thing as an international rules-based order. And that did lay certain foundations that still exist, some of those the other side mentioned in their opening, in terms of basic international institutions, most obviously the United Nations. But already by 1947, and certainly when you get to 1950, the Korean War, you know, I come to you from the Korean Peninsula, where you can't forget about the importance of the Korean War. But throughout the entire Cold War period, really, the world order was not premised on international cooperation and internationalism. It was premised on superpower rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. So there are almost kind of two orders already, a very brief internationalist order and then a long period of bipolarity in the Cold War, which ends obviously with the fall of the Soviet Union, ushering in this moment of American unipolarity. I think this question of, you know, and I think we may try to come back to this throughout the discussion, the question of U.S. hegemony and U.S. power is really what we're talking about when we say the current, the status quo world order. That unipolar dominance and hegemony that the United States enjoyed in the wake of its victory over the Soviet Union in the Cold War, that's really what we saw it, the United States, sustain through certainly the heights in the 1990s, but also then the depths of the global war on terror. And it's kind of then through the economic crisis of 2008 and the global financial crisis. And at this point, we're living, I think, in historical terms, in this transitional moment where it's kind of this old man who ran his race and is just staggering to the finish line, but the capacity is dwindling. Meanwhile, again, as Abigail already established, it's not only China, but driven by the centrality of the rise of China, Asia is creating some future new world order, none of which we know will, you know, the exact description of.
Next up, here are John Lee's arguments against the idea that Asia's rise will lead to a new world order. John is director of the East-West Futures Consultancy and a researcher at the Leiden Asia Center in the Netherlands.
I have to thank John for finishing on that note of confusion as to the other side's argument as to whether this is about the rise of China or about the rise of Asia. Because I would accept the proposition that China is indeed an engine, but that's only half the picture, because it's an engine that works as part of an interdependent system. And China rose and is still rising as part of this system, which includes not just the other Asian countries, but also what we call traditionally the first world. The US-aligned rich economies of which the country we are sitting in is a part. In fact, interdependence still rules, and that goes from both ends of this order, not just from the developing country side, but also from that of the wealthy countries, which for their part still hold the commanding heights in technology that the Asian world, China included, still relies on to drive that economic growth, which is said to be creating this new world order. For that matter, China itself, everyone knows now, is facing dire straits as a result of being potentially cut off from these core technologies, chips, etc., by action from Washington and its advanced allies. And indeed, all of the argument over capacity you read about shows how the rich country markets are still important, not just to China, but to developing countries. Because, of course, even if we talk about the developing world as a whole, we are talking not about replacement, but about reform of a common international order. And despite what the other side has tried to argue, this is exactly the difference that matters. We are not talking about a new order, but a rebalanced one. One in which developing countries are still wanting to hold to fundamental concepts like Westphalian sovereignty, a global collective system in the UN. What they want, and this goes for China as much as any of the others, is simply a reshifting of power that allows them to pursue their interests and is more equitable from their viewpoint, whether it's in terms of the application of international law between Ukraine and Gaza, or when it comes to the rebalancing of the global trade system. No one is arguing for a return to pre-Westphalian concepts of organization, whether we're talking about the Roman Empire or about a Sinocentric tributary system. Finally, I think we need to look again, when we talk about the rise of a new order, at what forces might push back against it. And I think it's important to understand that one reason you will not see a decisive different order is that the rich countries, which control the key technologies still in many respects, are not incentivized to align against China, as we have seen from the practice, or rather the lack of it, of decoupling or de-risking. The reality is that, and we must talk about what's possible in reality, not in theory, the political costs of building an alternative bloc that would be the mirror to this so-called new order that is supposedly arising around China, the costs are so high as to be unsustainable in political terms in Europe, the United States, the other advanced economies. I mean, think about it. Would you go out and convince those farmers striking in Berlin or in Amsterdam that they should subsidize hundreds of billions of euros to reshore supply chains that can be more cheaply located in Asia over the next few decades? What we are seeing instead is a push from all sides to redefine the existing system on terms that will be more advantageous, whether it's in terms of the risk, de-risking and reshoring on the advanced economies, or of a greater slice of the pie on the part of the developing world. Yet all of that is fundamentally taking place within the rules of the road, which go back not just to 1945, but indeed to the rise of the Western countries and the way that they completely redefined the international order. As I said, Westphalian sovereignty and a collective system of international law that no country, whether it's China or the United States, is seeking to replace with something else. And again, this is what we see reflected in the actual practice of our world today.
Those were the opening salvos from both teams. During the live debate, we went into an extended discussion and Q&A, allowing a proper deep dive into the issue. It's included in the full video of the event, available on our website and on the Asia Society YouTube channel. I highly recommend you watch it. A link is in the show notes. Here on the podcast, we're keeping it a bit more concise and jump straight to the 2-minute closing arguments from each debater. First up, here again is Abigail Vasilier of Merix, arguing Asia's rise will lead to a new world order.
I think we have all agreed by now that there is no doubt about Asia's rise. The question is, what is going to be this new world order looking like? And I think John explained that we are not here to think about how much chaos this can bring, how much fragmentation this is going to bring. And I have a very gloomy picture. For me, we have failed to reform the UN system for decades now, and this is not going to change. I think further fragmentation is simply going to mean that our international institutions are failing. Having said that, we are here to debate whether Asia's rise will lead to a new world order. And I think you have a case about the demographics. I think I've made a case about the economic and financial driver that are going to reshape the new world order. And I think I've made a case about how much appealing the Asian model can be and the China model. And we may disagree, but let's face it, actually, most of the global South do agree that there is a case about the Chinese economic development model. So yes, we as Europeans may have to adapt and adjust to these new realities. Whether we like them or not, that's not what we are debating today. But for what we have to acknowledge is that the challenges and opportunities that Asia's rise is going to present will bring us together to this new world.
Next, arguing against, here's Julia Gunter of the Kerber Foundation.
I made a couple of examples in the beginning where we shouldn't be too Asia-centric, and my colleagues even have been very China-centric, I have to say, and I want to stick to that point because there's really a couple of countries on the rise too outside of Asia, and we would really make miss big time if we just ignore that they are on the rise, that they have a say, that they are going to assume leadership roles as well, and that with all of that, with their increasing self-confidence in so many countries, I've given you the numbers in the beginning, that this will also have an impact on the kind of world order that we will see and the changes. But as I've said, reforms, not revolution, and I'm going to stick to that point, and I don't want to be so pessimistic about the options that we have for reform. I don't want to make a point that we will see a United Nations Security Council reform happening soon, of course. I mean, but there are so many other initiatives. There's a Bridgetown initiative on climate financing. Leaders met last year in Paris. President Macron invited them to discuss the financial international architecture. They came up with an agreement. So there's things happening. And we have to consider also that these countries really have a new self-confidence. It's not the same debate that we are having at the moment than a couple of years ago, because these countries have changed as well. So there is also the Pact for the Future in the UN. So there's several things happening, and we really have to consider that and not be too pessimistic about reform. And I want to make one last point, because this was said by the other group a couple of times. The China model is really not attractive. So it's, even if they are, if they see China as an opportunity, they send their kids to universities in other countries, not to China, because it's not a model that is attractive for them. And I think this is a really relevant point that we must consider. They won't follow the Chinese model. They have their own opinions, and they will vocalize them loudly.
And now, making a final push to convince the audience Asia's rise will lead to a new world order, here's John Delurie of Seoul's Yonsei University.
I mean, just as an aside, I'm an American, but I hope my kids don't go to school in the United States. And in fact, now they're not. So. I think the other side had a very tough job ahead of them. And so in order to, get you to be skeptical about the proposition, they had to sort of fall back on other arguments. And no one seemed to dispute that Asia is rising. We don't dispute other parts of the world are rising, that Africa and other parts of the world are rising, and those are very important developments. But again, that wasn't really the question that we were brought here to debate. I worried that I was going to be doing too much history when I went back to 1945. Little did I know they'd go back to Westphalia and the Industrial Revolution. But there's a serious point there, which is I think they had to define the world order in those terms of a matter of centuries, because if we take the meaning of world order, if you agree more with our, I think, more common sense definition of world order as the world that we've lived in, the geopolitics, also the economic interdependence, the globalization, that was the case since the end of the Cold War, our contention is we are watching that unravel. I mean, here's the short list. The global financial crisis, the Eurozone crisis, Brexit, we didn't even talk about. Trump, we didn't even talk about. Trump maybe coming back, we didn't talk about. COVID, Ukraine, Gaza, and that list is not done. There will be more to that list, right? And again, our contention is what was holding back a lot of those forces was U.S. predominance. The U.S. was peerless. The United States, by its own admission, if you read the last national security statement, says we now have peer competitors, Russia and China. So economically and in security terms, we're watching it fall apart. A new order, even if it's chaos, will emerge.
Wrapping up arguing against the motion, here's the closing statement from John Lee of East-West Futures and the Leiden Asia Center.
Firstly, there must be a high bar for a new order. The other side have tried to convince us heroically that it can be about a redistribution of power, for which I think there is no argument, or about a shift in the distribution of trade. I would submit, if we talk about order, it must be about structuring principles, the way that academics often discuss international order. And that, at the very least, we would have to see, to argue for the rise of a new order, some evidence that, let's say, developing countries en masse are following Chinese leadership. Even if we cannot see the outlines, there has to be the spirit there or the tendency. And what I see, what our team has argued, that this is, again, about very well-established interests and preferences, which are being pursued in ways which are much more confrontational for we who live, fortunately, in the rich countries than we have been confronted with in the past. The other reason that I'm optimistic that the existing order will last is that there is no time for a fundamental new order to develop. If we did not face a climate crisis, which is going to affect all countries drastically within the next one or two decades, if we had longer, then we could talk about the potential space for a new international order to develop. But the reality is that today, however hawkish they are on China, US and European politicians still always caveat by saying, and yet we need to work with them on climate change. And from the developing countries, and I've already talked about many of these states literally facing being underwater. I mean, we even talk about India, Bangladesh, big developing countries for whom this is an existential threat that leaves no time or headspace to worry about fundamental new orders.
There you have it, a concise, dense exchange of top-shelf arguments on a highly relevant and complicated issue. Will Asia's rise lead to a new world order? At the live event, the audience got to vote on the motion both before and after the debate. The results showed a shift we've never seen before in any of the 15 Oxford debates we've organized before this one. It's all included in the full video, which again is available on the Asia Society YouTube channel and our website, asiasociety.org/Switzerland. That's where you'll also find information on the many other events and activities we organize, as well as details on how to support us and a link to sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's all for this episode of the podcast. We'll be back next week with an exclusive conversation on India's election and its ruling party, the BJP. The world's biggest democracy is going to the polls starting April 19th in an election that will take 6 weeks to complete. Be sure to subscribe to not miss out on that conversation and all future episodes. For now, my name is Remco Tanis. Thanks for listening.